Well, it is time for us to wish our listeners who are celebrating a birthday on this Wednesday, February 21, a very happy birthday. We have Rita Booman from Dubuque, Florence Flo Gamble of West Des Moines, Floyd Hawkins from Fort Dodge, Sally Jennett from Storm Lake, and Deanna Lavelle from Urbandale. All of us here at IRIS would like to wish all of you, a very happy birthday. And a reminder, you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you're not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now, here's Barb with today's obituaries.
Thank you, Dennis. Vincent Thomas Weber of Ankeny died at home on February 18th. He is survived by his wife, Sharon Lasson, extended family, and many friends. Visitation will be held at Armstrong Funeral Home in Mount Air on Friday, February 23rd, from 10 to 11 a.m., with services beginning at 11 a.m. The complete obituary can be seen at armstrongfh.com. Norman Otis, 86, passed away February 14th in Kansas City, Missouri. Norman was a professional engineer who went to North High School and graduated from Arizona State University. The funeral will be Monday, February 19th at 11 a.m. at Olivet Baptist Church at 4901 Mission Road in Westwood, Kansas, with burial at Westfield Cemetery in Grinnell, Iowa. Floral Hills Funeral Home in Kansas City is handling the arrangements. Joanne E. Claypool, 83, passed away February 17th at Bishop Drum Retirement Center in Johnston. A graveside service will be held at 2 o'clock p.m. Friday, February 23rd at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. For the last 10 years, Joanne lived in Urbandale but was previously a resident of Marion. She enjoyed working as an analyst for Rockwell Collins in Cedar Rapids. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Animal Rescue League of Iowa or Noah's Ark Animal Foundation. Online condolences may be directed to the family at cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. Janine M. Wycliffe, 94, of Green Valley, Arizona, was born December 15, 1929, in Des Moines and passed away on January 5, 2024. Preceding her in death were her husband, Richard Wycliffe, her parents, and her six siblings. She was a January 1948 graduate of North High School in Des Moines and wrote the yearbook dedication for her class. Des Moines was home for much of her life. During her last few years, Janine lived at Prestige Assisted Living in Green Valley. She loved to read, play bingo and dominoes, eat banana chocolate chip bread, and have lively conversations. She enjoyed weekly visits from Ace, her grand dog. Long-distance family and friends chatted with her daily on her grandpad. For several years, Janine enjoyed traveling with Richard. They enjoyed extensive trips all over the U.S. as well as internationally and lived in Tehran, Iran for a year. From those adventurous trips came many unforgettable stories and friendships. Memorials may be made to the Alzheimer's Association. James, known as Jim E. Carter of Perry, a beloved husband, father, grandfather, and veteran of the United States Navy, passed away peacefully at his home on February 15th. He was 90 years old. Visitation will be from 10 a.m. until the time of the service at 11 a.m. Thursday, February 22nd, at Caldwell Parish Funeral Home, Perry Chapel, at 1721 Park Street in Perry. Private family burial will take place in Violet Hill Cemetery in Perry. Born on April 4, 1933, in Norton, Kansas, James was the only child of Marion Edison Carter and Thelma Louise Thompson. On February 14, 1956, he married the love of his life, LaDonna Daniels, in a ceremony in Goodland, Kansas. Their enduring bond was a testament to their commitment and love for each other. James served his country honorably as a member of the U.S. Navy from 1951 to 1955, bravely serving during the Korean conflict. Following his military service, he pursued a career as a train dispatcher for the BNSF Railroad, where his dedication and work ethic earned him the respect of colleagues and supervisors alike. In lieu of flowers, please direct memorial contributions to the Perry Country Club. Caldwell Parish Funeral Home and Crematory in Perry, Iowa, is in charge of the arrangements. Cheryl Gilge, 71, of Urbandale, passed away February 18th as a result of glioblastoma. She was born June 11, 1962, in Cedar Falls to Bruce and Marilyn Stritzenberg. She lived her childhood years in several small towns in Iowa, including Garner and Eagle Grove. She received her degree as a registered nurse from the University of Iowa and master's degree in nursing from the University of Nebraska Medical Center. She spent her career as a nurse working in oncology, hospice, and home care. Cheryl married her husband Joe in 1990. Her daughter Katie was born in 1993 and her son Brian in 1994. Her grandson Oliver was born in 2022. She was a devoted wife, mother, and grandson. Cheryl enjoyed her volunteer work at Gloria Day Lutheran Church and Urbandale Food Pantry. Over many years, she made over 10,000 stocking hats for nonprofit organizations. A visitation will be held at Gloria Day Lutheran Church in Urbandale on the evening of Thursday, February 22nd, from 5 to 7 p.m. Funeral services will be at Gloria Day Lutheran Church on Friday, February 23rd, at 11 a.m. Burial will be in Rest Haven Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Urbandale Food Pantry and Gloria Day Lutheran Church. Online condolences may be expressed at islescares.com. Joseph Allen Smith, 90, of Des Moines, passed away on Friday, February 16th. A visitation will be held Friday, February 23rd, from 5 to 7 p.m. at McLaren's Rest Haven Chapel in West Des Moines. A funeral mass will be the next day at 10 a.m. at St. Augustine's Catholic Church in Des Moines. Joe had a deep heart for the needs of people in the Des Moines community. As vice president of fundraising for the United Way of Central Iowa from 1977 to 1988, Joe brought significant changes in planning, policy, and corporate participation that helped grow and expand the level of giving and impact of the United Way in the Des Moines area. After United Way, he worked endlessly to help nonprofits with their fundraising campaigns and was particularly involved and fond of the Salisbury House. He worked for EMC Insurance Company at the end of his career as Director of Community Relations. He was very giving to all and made it a point to make donations to many. Joe volunteered for a number of organizations, but was particularly committed to the Catholic Worker House. Over the years, he mentored and encouraged countless young people to help them enter the world of business. Memorial contributions may be directed to the Salisbury House in Des Moines in memory of Joe. Visit McLaren'sResthavenChapel.com for the Smith family. Marlene Ann Weiner, 88, passed away peacefully at her home, Mill Pond, on February 17th. Visitation will be held from 3:30 to 5 p.m. on Thursday, February 22nd, at Memorial Services of Iowa at 4208 North Ankeny Boulevard, with the memorial services following at 5 p.m. Marlene's final resting place will be at Ankeny Memorial Gardens. Marlene was born in Sully, Iowa, on June 23, 1935, to William and Emily Bowie. She grew up in Pilla and Oskaloosa with her seven brothers and sisters, but spent most of her school years in Council Bluffs, where she graduated from the Iowa School for the Deaf. In high school, she was active in multiple sports and activities, including basketball, cheerleading, skating, and she loved to sew. After high school, Marlene married her high school sweetheart, Darrell Weiner, and was married for 64 wonderful years, doing everything together. They moved to Spencer, Iowa, and later moved to Ankeny, where she worked at Warren's Incorporated in Ames for 35 years. After retirement, they moved to Surprise, Arizona, to enjoy golfing, sun, and friendships, and eventually made their way back to Ankeny. She was an active member of the Calvary Deaf Lutheran Church and very involved with Ladies' Aid and Fellowship at her church. She exemplified the true meaning of Christ, a Christ follower, in her daily walk, loving others, and showing her joy to the world. Visit online at ankenymemorial.com.
Thank you, Barb. That concludes today's obituaries. Continuing now with national news. Haley vows to keep fighting for GOP nods. Says in South Carolina, another Trump term in the White House would be, quote, a disaster. A defiant Nikki Haley said Tuesday that she will not be leaving the GOP presidential race in spite of a pressure campaign from former President Donald Trump and his allies. Quote, I feel no need to kiss the ring, and I have no fear of Trump's retribution. I'm not looking for anything from him, Haley said during a fiery speech. Her campaign had stirred speculation on Monday that Haley would quit when it announced her plans to deliver a, quote, state of the race address. But Haley took the opportunity to instead double down on her criticism of Trump. I'm not going anywhere, Haley told the media and a group of roughly 50 supporters. Haley also sought to show a softer side not seen at her previous rallies. She began crying as she talked about her husband Michael's military deployment overseas as she noted he was unable to join her on the trail. Trump previously mocked the absence of Haley's husband and questioned his whereabouts during a rally in early February. Issuing some of her sharpest words yet targeted at the former president, Haley argued that another Trump administration would be a disaster, and that many Republican politicians who publicly support his candidacy dread him behind closed doors. Haley has reiterated claims that she is better equipped than Trump, age 77, to defeat President Joe Biden, age 81, in a general election matchup. Haley highlighted concerns over both of their ages, calling them, quote, two old men who are getting older. The truth is, Americans already know what Joe Biden and Donald Trump will do, Haley said. They're dividers at a time when America desperately, urgently needs a uniter. However, she dismissed claims that she is running as a, quote, never Trump candidate and emphasized her work as an ambassador to the United Nations during his administration. Like most Americans, I have a handful of serious concerns about the former president. But I have countless serious concerns about the current president, she said, attacking Biden for his handling of immigration and the economy, among other issues. Trump has attempted to portray Haley as a liberal-leaning in recent weeks. His super PAC, Make America Great Again, Incorporated, released a memo recently questioning whether Haley was trying to replace Vice President Kamala Harris on the Democratic ticket. Every dollar spent by Nikki Haley is a dollar spent in support of Joe Biden and the Democrats, said the group's spokesperson, Alex Pfeiffer. In her speech, Haley rejected chatter that she's staying in the race for her own future political ambitions. Other people say I'm trying to set up a future presidential run. How does that even work? I was running for a bogus reason. If I was running for a bogus reason, I would have dropped out a long time ago, she said. Haley had pledged on Monday evening to remain in the race until Super Tuesday, telling her supporters during a rally that she planned to head to Michigan on Sunday. Michigan's primary is February 27th. Haley will then face a critical stretch of campaigning in 15 states and one territory ahead of their March 5th contest. Her campaign previously signaled that it views the date as a crucial one for her candidacy. In an exclusive Suffolk University USA Today poll released Tuesday, Trump is poised to trounce Haley Saturday in South Carolina. Among those very likely to vote in the state's Republican primary, Trump leads Haley by close 2-1, 63% to 35%. Haley urged voters in her home state to disregard the polls. I have a quick reminder to all South Carolinians. In a general election, you're given a choice. In a primary, you make your choice, she said. Trump's top campaign aides said in a Tuesday morning memo that based on its projections, the former president will amass the required 1,215 delegates to win the GOP nomination no later than March 19th. The true state of Nikki Haley's campaign? Broken down, out of ideas, out of gas, and completely outperformed by every measure by Donald Trump. Trump advisor Chris Lasavide and Susie Wiles wrote, relief swelled over supporters after listening to Haley's story where she promised to stay in the race after South Carolina votes on February 24, no matter what the results show. Cynthia Long, a local to downtown Greenville, South Carolina, said that Haley represents a choice for voters. I think staying in as long as she can afford to is a good thing because it gives the people a choice, Long said. Even if Haley loses to Trump by a margin larger than 10 points, she hopes to see Haley stay in the race all the way to the convention. South Carolina State Representative Bart Blackwell, who represents Aiken, echoed the same hopes. He also does not think the polls, which are showing Trump leads over Haley in her home state, are accurate. I think we're going to be surprised on Saturday. That's what American people want. They want a choice, and the race is far from over, Blackwell said. And I'm just thrilled with her decision, and I admire her courage for continuing forward.
Justices to hear smog reduction plan. A pollution showdown hits the Supreme Court on Wednesday as it considers the Biden administration's controversial Good Neighbor plan to reduce ground-level ozone. Ohio, Indiana, and West Virginia want to pause the administration's attempt to combat smog-forming pollution that drifts into other states. But nine other states whose residents breathe in that smog say such a phase pause would exacerbate asthma and other health issues for their residents and burden them with a high cost of controlling pollution. Industries are also requesting a hold on enforcement. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals declined to put the plan on hold while its legality is being challenged. One of the most widespread pollutants in the United States, smog is also one of the most dangerous, according to the American Lung Association. It causes breathing difficulties, worsens lung diseases, and shortens lives. More than 100 million Americans live in counties with repeated instances of unhealthy ozone levels, the main component of smog, according to the Association's latest report. The Biden administration imposed the Good Neighbor Plan on large industrial polluters in 23 states last year, after rejecting 21 state proposals as ineffective. Two other states failed to submit a plan. The federal program, the Environmental Protection Agency told the Supreme Court, strikes a proper balance between the interests of upwind and downwind states. But the states challenging the regulations say they shouldn't have to bear the cost of complying with what they call a power grab by the Biden administration. They argue the Good Neighbor Plan requires an excessive amount of pollution control and will eventually be struck down by the courts. The plan inflicts irreparable economic injuries on the states and others every day it remains in effect, lawyers for Ohio, Indiana, and West Virginia told the court. The increased reduction requirements are already on hold in 12 of the 23 affected states. Those states are separately challenging the EPA's rejection of their approved pollution control plans. Clean air advocates fear a repeat of what happened in the Obama administration's signature climate change policy. Then the Supreme Court put the Clean Power Plan on hold while it was being challenged. The delay eventually allowed the Trump administration to scrap the plan. Quote, the Supreme Court's taken a particular and distressing interest in environmental laws, said Sam Sanker, senior vice president of the Earth Justice Environmental Group. It's sort of saying, look, these things are guilty until proven innocent. And that's a new way for the courts to be treating environmental regulations, end quote. Since the 1990s, the government has used good neighbor rules to take into account the fact that pollutants can travel hundreds of miles, causing a significant share of the pollution in another state. In Connecticut's Fairfield County, for example, ozone-forming emissions from upwind states are responsible for as much as 57% of the area's ozone, according to a brief filed by the downwind states of New York, Connecticut, Delaware, Illinois, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. They argued that while many upwind states can still use low-cost, widely available pollution control equipment, options are more expensive for downwind states that are already heavily controlling their own emissions. New York, for example, already requires controls that cost up to $5,500 per ton of pollutants reduced. That's compared with the $1,600 per ton cost of controls required in the new term for sources in Ohio, Indiana, and West Virginia, according to New York's court filing. The emissions come from coal-fired power plants, steel mills, cement factories, natural gas pipeline engines, and other sources. Without federal intervention, upwind states will engage in deregulatory race to the bottom to attract industries away from other states at the expense of public health and welfare, they wrote. Unless the plan is paused everywhere, the states argue, they will have to spend too much time and money on compliance measures, including reporting requirements and issuing or updating permits while waiting to see if the court upholds the plan. The tighter pollution limits could also leave states without sufficient power sources if power plants shut down because it's too expensive to comply, according to the challenging states. Quote, if the federal plan is unlawful, the state applicants should be relieved from the harms the plan is imposing now, lawyers for Ohio, Indiana, and West Virginia wrote in the filing. The EPA told the court that many of the requirements don't kick in until 2026. Near-term costs are not high and won't jeopardize power supplies, according to the agency. By contrast, the government's lawyers said, halting enforcement while the rule is being challenged could result in years of delay for significant emissions reductions. Most of the expected reductions in nitrogen oxide emissions from iron and steel mills, for example, would come from Indiana and Ohio. Quote, it would be great if we controlled all of the pollutants and sources, but it is absolutely good to control some of them, Sankar of Earth Justice said. Controlling pollution sources is always a good thing.
Court lets school diversity move stand. Trump lawyers, GOP reps also see appeals rejected. The Supreme Court disappointed three sets of petitioners Tuesday, a group of Virginia parents, Sidney Powell, and three Republican U.S. House members. In a significant move, the High Court declined to review a controversial admissions policy meant to increase diversity at one of the nation's most prestigious public high schools. By declining the appeal, the Supreme Court leaves in place the appeals court ruling that upheld the policy. Justice Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas disagreed, siding with plaintiffs who said the policy violated the Constitution. The call on the Virginia case came months after the Supreme Court ended the use of affirmative action at Harvard and the University of North Carolina. Other universities, schools, and businesses have been reviewing diversity policies to ensure that they can withstand legal scrutiny. The Supreme Court also let stand sanctions against a group of lawyers who challenged President Joe Biden's 2020 victory in Michigan, rejecting appeals from Powell, Linwood, and five other lawyers allied with former President Donald Trump. It did not comment on that rejection. Finally, again without comment, the court declined an appeal from Representative Thomas Mazzi, Ralph Norman, and Marjorie Taylor Greene in their suit against former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi for docking their pay over mask mandates. Against the backdrop of the murder of George Floyd in 2020, Virginia's Fairfax County School Board changed its admissions policy at a magnet school, Thomas Jefferson High School, for science and technology. It is often ranked as one of the best high schools in the nation, but Black and Hispanic students made up only a small portion of the student body. The new policy required the school to accept 1.5% of the 8th grade class at each of the district's middle schools. Because some of the district's middle schools are made up predominantly of minority students, guaranteeing admission to a portion of the graduating class increased diversity at Jefferson. The school board said the policy was race neutral because it set no racial targets and the race of applicants was not known to admissions officials. In other words, the policy is based on geography, not race. Jefferson's current freshman class, which was admitted under the new policy, has a significantly different racial makeup. Black students increased from 1% of the student body to 7%, according to court records. Hispanic representation increased from 3 to 11%. Asian American representation decreased from 73% to 54%. A group of parents asserted that the policy had the effect of increasing the number of Black students but had a substantial adverse impact on Asian American students, violating the 14th Amendment. U.S. District Judge Claude Hilton agreed and ruled that impermissible racial balancing was at the core of the new admissions policy. But a three-judge panel of the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals reversed that decision. The appeals court said it was not satisfied that the board's adoption of the challenged admissions policy fully comports with the 14th Amendment's demand of equal protection under the law. That policy, the court ruled, visits no racial disparate impact on Asian American students. What the 4th Circuit majority held, in essence, is that intentional racial discrimination is constitutional, so long as it's not too severe, Alito wrote in a dissent that Thomas joined. This reasoning is indefensible, and it cries out for correction. He thought the appeals court showed a clearly mistaken understanding of what it means for a law or policy to have a disparate effect on the members of a particular racial or ethnic group. The Supreme Court had reviewed the Jefferson case at an earlier stage when the plaintiffs asked the justices to temporarily block the policy while the case continued in lower courts. The court declined the request, with Thomas Alito and Justice Neil Gorsuch saying they would have blocked the policy. In Michigan, Powell, Wood, and several other lawyers spearheaded a legal effort to award the battleground state's electoral college votes to Trump despite his loss. The district judge called their suit a historic and profound abuse of the judicial process and imposed financial and professional sanctions. The 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld most of those sanctions. The appeals court said many of the lawyers' allegations of fraud were refuted by their own evidence. Others relied on clearly unreliable expert reports or were simply baseless. In their appeal, the lawyers argued the sanctions would chill legitimate election challenges. They also charged Democrats with trying to marginalize political opponents and destroy their counsel. Wood, who has argued he did not work on the lawsuit and was not included in all the sanctions, filed a separate appeal. Lawyers for the city of Detroit said the suit was part of a broader effort to delegitimize the election results and prevent the peaceful transfer of power. Any attorney with the slightest understanding of Michigan election law and procedures had to know that these claims were destined for dismissal, the city's lawyers told the Supreme Court. There is no First Amendment right to file frivolous litigation. The lawyers owe almost $133,000 to Detroit and were ordered to pay more than $19,000 in legal fees to the state. Green, Massey, and Norman had their pay docked $500 for flouting a mask mandate on the floor of the House of Representatives during the COVID-19 pandemic. They argued that unless the Supreme Court sided with them, lawmakers would continue to be retaliated against for acting in accordance with the desires of their district rather than the desires of the Speaker of the House. The lower court said Pelosi could not be sued because courts don't have jurisdiction over Congress's internal rules. Lawyers for House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, agreed. This case is not about the wisdom of the rule or whether it was based on sound science, but whether the fines can be contested in court, they wrote. Well, that's it for this first part of the Register. For the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Barbara Heck and Dennis May. It has been our pleasure to read for you. And now we're going to take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
for the last 90 minutes.
Welcome back.
Your new readers are Patty Daniels, and there's something wrong with my brain this morning, Pam Rhodes. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today, and here's Pam with our next article.
Why do evangelical voters flock to Trump and his sinful ways? This article is written by Chris Brennan, who is an election columnist and on X, formerly known as Twitter. Donald Trump is known for many things: bankrupt casinos, claims of adultery, bragging about sexual assault, actual sexual assault, paying hush money to a porn star, and then winning and losing the presidency. It's not the stuff of Sunday church sermons, unless the topic is the road to hell. But there is one more thing Trump is known for: remarkably strong and lasting support among white evangelical Christian voters. How does he do that? How does Trump persuade voters who say they consider their faith when casting ballots to look his way and say, "Yeah, that's my kind of guy"? I asked some people who would know. The consensus: many evangelicals don't need Trump to be a person of faith, or even a good person, if they feel like he has their backs. Troy Miller, who heads the Association of National Religious Broadcasters, will have Trump address the group's International Christian Media Convention in Nashville on Thursday. I can say, from all of the people I meet with and talk to, and from personal experience, even in my own family, with lifelong Democrats, Trump has this appeal. People feel he understands them, Miller told me, even though some of his life stuff doesn't fit into their personal lifestyle or morality, they still feel like he gets them. Trump leads hard into that. Last month, he posted on his social media website a bizarrely self-aggrandizing video that cast him as a Masonic figure while he was campaigning in Iowa ahead of the state's caucuses. The video opened with this narration: "And on June 14, 1946, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, 'I need a caretaker.' So God gave us Trump." The Bible takes a dim view of such displays of ego and pride, and the video disturbs some evangelical pastors in Iowa. Even so, Trump had an easy victory there, with support from 53% of voters who identified as evangelical. Trump doesn't have to worry about his evangelical supporters holding him accountable. They've shown no inclination for that since he emerged as a Republican frontrunner in 2016. Brad Atkins, a Baptist preacher for a church with more than 3,000 members in Spartanburg County, was one of more than 100 faith leaders who endorsed Trump ahead of Saturday's South Carolina's Republican primary for president. Atkins, no stranger to Republican presidential politics, cited Trump's creation of a White House Faith and Opportunity Initiative as one reason to back him. Appointing Supreme Court justices who overturned a constitutional protection for abortion was another. Irregardless of how overt he is with his faith, he always made faith something he was a stalwart for, Atkins said. Since Trump has left office, one jury of his peers found in a civil case that he had sexually assaulted the writer E. Jean Carroll, while a second jury awarded her $83 million in damages for his attempts to attack her character about that assault. I had to ask. Atkins didn't seem at all moved by any of that. I think everybody has a past that has an impact on their present, he said. That's probably a lot of regret that everyone has in their past that they don't want to bring up. In one way, that's a clear embrace of Christianity's notion that we're all sinners. In another way, it's a huge pass for one guy because Trump never shows regret for anything he does to other people. Nevertheless, it is consistent. Atkins told the Financial Times at the height of the 2016 Republican primaries that Trump's indiscretions are more visible than the other contenders, but that he was sure they too had indiscretions in their pasts. John Fee, a history professor at Messiah University in Pennsylvania, explained it as a contractual relationship between Trump and his evangelical supporters. He delivers for them. They tolerate him, said Fee, who contributed an essay in the 2020 book to the book The Spiritual Dangers of Donald Trump, 30 Evangelicals on Justice, Truth, and Moral Integrity. It wasn't always that way. Not all evangelicals support Trump, of course, and Fay said some of them backed Senator Joe Biden in 2020 because he had a record as a moderate Democrat who worked in a bipartisan manner. I think Biden disappointed those voters by pushing to the left on social issues, Fay said. Now the Democrats, with Biden at the top of the ticket, are making the revocation of abortion rights a clarion call for their base to turn out in November with Trump as the top target. I don't think Trump cares one bit about abortion, whether it's pro-choice or pro-life, Fee said. It's a political wedge issue that he can use to seek power. And questions about Trump's character no longer matter. The politics of character in American evangelicalism, is over, Fee said. It's all policy-driven. 8 years ago, with Trump as a Republican nominee, the National Religious Broadcasters Association held a debate among the high-profile evangelicals to consider if they could or should support him for president. Erickson, a conservative broadcaster and pundit, cited in that 2016 debate Trump's adultery, his various business schemes that left fans fleeced and workers unpaid, as reasons for evangelicals to reject him. Add to that, Erickson said, Trump's own assertion on the campaign trail that year that he had never asked God for forgiveness. Erickson called that a failure of Christianity 101. Erickson's caustic criticism was washed out by evangelical support for Trump that year. The conservative pundit reversed course in 2019 and endorsed Trump's bid for a second term. AP Votecast, a survey of American electorate by the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago for media partners that include the USA Today network, found Trump won the support of about 8 in 10 white evangelical Christian voters in 2020, an echo of his support from that group 4 years earlier. A contract is a contract, it seems. When it comes to religion and politics, Trump will keep winning evangelical support as long as he looks like a winner, no matter what the rest of his life looks like.
I don't want to die. Palestinians reveal gap in refugee protection. Nuha Bashir's life in Deir Abala City, Gaza, was a happy one. The mother of twin 9-year-old girls, she had just started a consulting business. It was almost time to harvest the olive trees around her home. October 7th changed everything. The Hamas attacks and ensuing war with Israel closed in around Nuha and her family. Nuha opened her home to more than 50 people, but soon their solar power system broke from nearby bombardment, leaving no power and no water. Then their neighbor's building was bombed. The explosion shattered their own windows and walls. Nuha, her husband, and the girls fled, first to an aunt's and then to her parents. The violence continued. Cuts to power, water, and food made daily life nearly impossible. I could not stay powerless to my children, to see my children under danger, awaiting death, Nuha told Refugees International recently. On November 3rd, Nuha and her family were able to get on a U.S. embassy list for evacuations out of Gaza to Egypt because of her brother-in-law's affiliation with NPR. They were notified in the middle of the night that they needed to come to the border to make the crossing. They had no time to say goodbye to their family. They made the journey south toward Rafah underneath drones and bombs. It was one of the most dangerous situations I ever took in my life, she said. I cannot do anything, Nuha told Refugees International. I cannot withdraw money. I cannot go to school. I cannot enroll my children in a school. With no end in sight to the deadly fighting in Gaza, urgent action must be taken to ensure that families like Nuwa's do not fall through the cracks. For a start, Egypt has a few options. UN agencies could be equipped to help Palestinians in Egypt. Egypt could collaborate with UN agencies and international nonprofits to more formally provide timely support under the exceptional circumstances to Palestinian refugees. To incentivize Egypt's flexibility, donors need to step up both to fund support for displaced Palestinians in Egypt and develop alternative pathways for the most vulnerable to seek refuge in third countries. Canada has taken some initial steps and announced temporary visas for 1,000 family members of Palestinian dual citizens who evacuated Gaza. The United States and other nations should implement similar visa systems or legal pathways, especially for families like Nuwa's, who escaped under the U.S. evacuee list. These numbers are manageable, and in the case for the United States, is the least government can do to assist the Palestinian families when they evacuated but now are stuck in Egypt. If the conflict keeps space apace, prioritizing solutions now will be critical to avert a worse crisis. It is increasingly clear that more people will be forced to flee, and most Palestinians who do might not be able to return. Imagine yourself in the same situation, Nuwa said. If you are going to die or leave through Egypt, you will leave. Though you love your country, you love your land. I want to stay in my land, but I don't want to die. And the article was written by Sarah Sheffer and Jesse Marks. And Sarah is Refugees International Vice President for Strategic Outreach. And Jesse Marks is Refugees International Senior Advocate for the Middle East. They recently returned from the region.
We're going to turn to the sports schedules on TV now. For Wednesday, February 21st, and note that all of these times are in the Eastern time zone. Canadian Hockey League, 7 p.m., NHLN, Flint at Saginaw. College Basketball Men's, 6 p.m., CBSSN, West Carolina at UNC Greensboro. 6:30 p.m., BTN, Illinois at Penn State. 7 p.m., ACCN, Clemson at Georgia Tech, ESPN, Duke at Miami, Florida, ESPN2, Florida at Alabama, ESPNU, Notre Dame at Louisville, FS1, St. John's at Georgetown, 8 p.m., CBSSN, Providence at Xavier, 8:30 p.m., BTN, Nebraska at Indiana, SECN, Georgia at Vanderbilt, 9 p.m., ESPN, Kentucky at LSU, ESPNU, Mississippi at Mississippi State, ESPNU, Tulsa at Wichita State, FS1, DePaul at Marquette, 10 p.m., CBSSN, Colorado State at New Mexico, WCCN, Pepperdine at Pacific. At 11 p.m., FS1, UNLV at Air Force, College Basketball Women's. 6:30 p.m., FS2, Xavier at Butler, College Softball. 3 p.m., PAC 12N, UTEP at Arizona State, doubleheader, game one. 5:30 p.m., PAC-12N, UTEP at Arizona State, doubleheader, game two. Golf. 10 p.m., on the Golf Channel, LPGA Tour, the Honda LPGA Thailand first round, Siam Country Club, Pattaya Old Course, Shanburi, Thailand. NHL Hockey, 7:30 p.m., TNT and Max, Philadelphia at Chicago. 10 p.m., TNT and Max, Boston at Edmonton. Soccer men's, 2:30 p.m., USA, Premier League, Luton Town at Liverpool. 3 p.m., CBS, UEFA Champions League, FC Barcelona at Napoli, round of 16, leg 1. 9:55 p.m., FS2, CONCACAF, Champions Cup, Orlando City SC at Calvary FC, first round, leg 1. Tennis, 3 a.m., Tennis, Rio de Janeiro ATP, Los Cabos ATP, Doha ATP, and Dubai WTA early rounds. 11 a.m., Tennis, Rio de Janeiro ATP, Los Cabos ATP, Doha ATP, and Dubai WTA early rounds. 7 p.m., Tennis, Rio de Janeiro ATP, Los Cabos ATP, Doha ATP, and Dubai WTA early rounds.
I do believe that it's time for... No, it isn't. Let's do some sports. We have time to do a little bit more sports. Sorry, a little confusion here. Clark's career to be documented in New Des Moines Register book. This is written by the Hawk Central staff. University of Iowa's basketball, women's basketball fans, the Des Moines Register and Iowa City Press Citizen are producing a coffee table book about Caitlin Clark's hoops career. The 160-page book will feature photography and stories from Clark's years at Dowling High School in West Des Moines and her college years as a Hawkeye. Titled, Caitlin Clark, The Journey of Iowa's Brightest Star from Her High School Career to Breaking Records at the University of Iowa and Captivating the Nation. The 160-page hardcover book will include combinations from the Register and Press Citizen writers and photographers. Readers can expect behind-the-scenes anecdotes and storytelling from journalists who have established themselves as the experts on Hawkeye women's basketball. From her All-American high school career at Dowling Catholic to breaking records for the Iowa Hawkeyes, this collector's book puts you inside Caitlin Clark's chase for basketball immortality. And as she captivated the country with sold-out games and sky-high ticket prices, notes Pediment Publishing, which is collaborating with the Register and Press Citizen on the book. Full of dynamic photos, exclusive stories, and interviews from the Des Moines Register and Iowa City Press Citizen journalism, this is the ultimate retrospective of a magical career. Pre-orders are underway at pediment.com, and books are expected to ship May 7th, 2024. The pre-order price is $3, $31.95, and includes a 20% discount. Go to pediment.com and search for Caitlin.
ISU offensive coordinator Steele Hasse headed to LA Rams. Iowa State football will be looking for its third offensive coordinator in as many seasons. Cyclones offensive coordinator Nate Stielhasa is leaving Ames to become the passing game coordinator for the NFL's Los Angeles Rams. Iowa State coach Matt Campbell confirmed to the Register on Monday. Nate is going and will do a great job, Campbell told the Register in a text message. Honestly, an opportunity he couldn't pass up. Love him and will miss him, but truly a great opportunity for him. The report was initially reported on social media by ESPN NFL insider Adam Scheffler. Stielhase, widely considered one of the best young assistant coaches in college football, spent just one season at Iowa State's offensive coordinator. He oversaw significant improvement from a group that ranked among the country's worst prior to his arrival. The Cyclones went from 114th in scoring offense in 2022 to 70th last year, while moving from 113th in total offense to 79th last season. Those numbers, too, obscure the improvement Iowa State made in its efficiency as an offense that often prioritized ball control. They also do not reflect the hole the first-time coordinator and Cyclones dug themselves out of after a dismal start to the season that evolved into an offense that helped the Cyclones back to a bowl game with 7 regular season wins after a 4-8 campaign in 2022. Stielhase, 33, spent 6 years on Campbell's staff prior to his promotion, serving in different capacities such as a wide receivers and running backs coach. He also became the quarterbacks coach in 2023, overseeing Rocco Becht becoming a freshman All-American and Big 12 Conference's Offensive Freshman of the Year. Becht passed for more than 3,185 yards and 23 touchdowns while breaking many Iowa State freshman passing records. His 23 touchdown passes were the most for a Cyclone since Brock Purdy threw 27 in 2019. The development of Becht is especially impressive given he was slated to be the Cyclones' reserve quarterback. It wasn't until May when returning starter Hunter Deckers became involved in the state of Iowa's gambling probe that Becht was positioned to take over the job. Stielhase was a clear option for Campbell last offseason after flirting with Tom Manning, but the Cyclones may not have an obvious in-house option to replace Stielhase. Noah Pauley, wide receivers, and Ryan Clanton, offensive line, have been with the Cyclones for only 1 year. Taylor Mauser is Iowa State's tight ends coach, holds the assistant head coach title, and has been with Campbell since 2015 at Toledo. But tight ends coach is not a position often associated with an immediate promotion to coordinator. Iowa State has gone a season without a denoted offensive coordinator, with Campbell opting to leave the title empty in 2018 after Manning left for the Indianapolis Colts before returning as coordinator in 2019. Iowa State already had a vacant position on its offensive staff with a previously announced departure of running backs coach and special teams coordinator Jordan Langs. The timing of Stielhase's departure could prove difficult for Campbell, with spring practice set to begin soon for programs across the country and with the national coaching carousel mostly coming to a standstill. And this article was written by Randy Peterson, who is in his 52nd year of writing sports for the Des Moines Register. And now we will turn to Dear Abby. Dear Abby, father weighs revealing partner's health status. Dear Abby, I'm a gay man who came out late in life. I have 3 grown married children and 5 grandchildren. They are my world, and we are all very close. I've had 1 partner. My family readily accepted and welcomed him because he made me happy. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. I have been seeing another person, and our connection is very strong. We have lots in common. I think I'm falling in love, and I envision a future with him. He is HIV positive. I am on PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis, the most effective medication to prevent contracting HIV. We have not been intimate, but I'm aware of all the literature about the extremely low risk of transmission. My kids are bright, intelligent, and enlightened. I wonder if I should tell them about my boyfriend being positive. A part of me says that's true, and he should tell them if he feels compelled. I will not reveal it without his approval. Another part of me says it's not my children's business, because it applies only to intimate situations. But I've always been completely upfront with my kids about practically everything. So now I'm torn about what to do. Tell them, or he tells them, and risk getting a negative reaction, or I keep it a secret, no matter how uncomfortable that is for me. Please advise. Signed, How Honest in the East. Dear How Honest, if you were If there were a compelling reason for your adult children to know your friend's HIV status, I would urge you to tell them. However, because none of them are likely to have sex with this person, I see no reason to share that information. Dear Abby, I have one sister I love. Our parents passed away 12 years ago. We don't have a good relationship, although I try. Recently, we have been texting again. Her son is being married in a few months. I have three children. My 26-year-old has been in trouble a lot and caused my sister's family hurt. He's not going to the wedding. My other boys are younger, 18 and 21. They have never been in trouble. I have maintained somewhat of a relationship with my nephew. He has only three cousins on his mom's side. There are at least 17 cousins on his dad's side. Many of them have spouses, and they are all invited. My younger sons are not. Because I am deeply hurt, I have decided not to attend. My nephew's excuse for not inviting my sons was that attendance is tight. Am I wrong for not going? I can't help but think my sister and all but one of her kids don't want a relationship with my family. Should I let it go or continue pursuing a relationship when it seems obvious the feeling is not reciprocated? Signed, Deeply Hurt in Texas. Dear Deeply Hurt, I caution you against overreacting by boycotting the wedding. If you attend, it will give you an opportunity to tighten family ties and to talk about how proud you are of your two younger sons who are on the straight and narrow. And you can contact Abby at www.dearabby.com.
That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Patty Daniels, and my partner at the microphone has been Pam Rhodes. Earlier, you heard Barb DeHeck and Dennis May. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and BenSoundMusic.com. Thank you for listening to Iowa's first and only radio reading service.